Good afternoon, everybody. I hope you're enjoying your stay in Prague as much as I am. Today, we're going to talk about DOA estimation with a vector sensor in the presence of noise, DOA being direction of arrival. This work was done together with Emmanuel Habitz and Sharon Ganot. So for a bit of motivation, conventionally, typically if we want to do DOA estimation or localization, we use an array of sensors which have a certain amount of spacing between them. On the other hand, a vector sensor is inherently a compact sensor. It doesn't require spacing. That's its chief advantage. There was some previous work done on DOA estimation. We did our own research, and we found out that we developed a method which turns out to generalize previously proposed methods, and it also improves the performance. Okay, so the question is a bit of background. So what actually is a vector sensor? I think the best way to answer that would be to compare a vector sensor with a typical microphone. So a typical microphone has one channel, a single channel, and usually it doesn't have directivity. It may have directivity. It would be a monopole. So a monopole is essentially a sphere, and it doesn't make any difference if I was speaking to the microphone from, let's say, this direction or from this direction. The signal which is received by the sensor would be identical. On the other hand, a vector sensor has four different channels. The first channel is a monopole, so that has that doesn't have any directionality. The other three are dipoles. A dipole is, as mentioned in the first presentation, is essentially a three-dimensional figure eight. It's sensitive at the it's most sensitive at two opposite ends of the of its directivity, and the dipoles are oriented according to the x, y, and z axes. Now, how can we construct a vector sensor? There are two, I don't want to elaborate so much, but there are two main ways we can do that. One way is with particle velocity sensors. Another way is with a differential microphone array. And both of these options are off the shelf, meaning you can buy products which do that. Okay, now we're going to give some notation. So we have four different channels. P is going to be used to describe the monopole channel. Vx, Vy, and Vz will respectively present the three different dipoles, or we can say this in brief as P and a vector V. Another property which is worth mentioning, and we're going to elaborate that on that further, is that if we take a linear combination of these four different channels, then the effective beam pattern is going to be known as a limason, which is neither a monopole nor a dipole. It's somewhere in between. And that gives us a little bit of flexibility, which we're going to exploit later. Okay, next we're going to discuss the assumptions which we made when we did our analysis. So first, our source is going to be denoted by S of n, n being the time index. The source is assumed to be in the far field, and therefore the wave, when it arrives at the vector sensor, can be considered to be a plane wave. The DOA is going to be represented as a unit vector U. That's the red vector which points from the vector sensor towards the source. And our goal is going to be to try to create a U hat. We're going to try to create an estimator which is going to closely approximate the true U. If we didn't have any noise, then this would be very straightforward. We wouldn't have an estimate. We could actually provide an accurate solution. But there is some noise. The noise which we're dealing with has uncorrelated components. There are four channels. They're all uncorrelated. Such a scenario can arise either with device noise coming from the sensor, static, or alternatively an isotropic field. Okay, now we're going to give a bit of background for the method. So we have a dipole, and a dipole, the three dipoles have fixed orientation. We might want a dipole which isn't directed on the x-axis. We might want a dipole which is directed somewhere in between. So technically, you could mechanically steer that, but that's not usually a viable solution. A much better solution would be electronic steering, which if we take a linear combination of the three dipoles, then we can, and the coefficients of that, the coefficients would be a unit vector Q. Then we can create, and we combine them, then we create a new dipole, a virtual dipole, which has a new orientation. So here we have Vx and Vy, two different dipoles. We weight them according to the unit vector Q, and we produce a new virtual dipole, which has a new orientation, and we don't have any limitation. We can point the dipole to any direction which we want. Okay, so the first degree of flexibility which we have is the orientation of the dipole, but we don't have to constrain ourselves to dipoles. We can combine the dipole with the monopole, as we do here. We have alpha times the monopole, 1 minus alpha times the virtual dipole, and that produces what we called earlier a limason, or a hybrid, a combination of a monopole and a dipole, and that gives us a whole family of different beam patterns. So here, for example, for alpha equals 1, we have a pure monopole. For alpha equals 0, we have a dipole. Alpha equals 0.5, we have a cardioid, and we can also have different subcardioid or supercardioid configurations. We're going to have to see later which one is optimal, but we have this degree of flexibility, and we're going to utilize it. Okay, now one more before we get to our method, we're going to have one more definition, and that's steered response power. So the steered response power, first we pick a beam pattern, alpha. In this case, we picked a certain limason, which is supercardioid. Next, we steer into a certain direction, q, q being a unit vector. And after that, we take over n, uppercase n, samples. We measure the power. That's what we have over here. Alpha times the monopole, 1 minus alpha times the virtual dipole. We measure this power, or the average energy, and that's known as the steered response power. And we can assume that as Q approaches the true direction of a rifle, we're going to tend to have a higher power level. And that's what we're going to exploit in our method. So now we're going to get to the method itself. What we're going to do is we're going to measure the SRP, the steered response power, for a given alpha. We have to determine which alpha is best, but we can do it for any alpha between 0 and 1. And we want to find the unit vector for which the SRP is maximal. So theoretically, we could say that what we're actually doing is we're going to perform a search across the unit sphere. We have to constrain Q to be to have a unit norm. We're going to perform a search, and we're going to find the direction of maximum power. Ideally, we don't want to have to do an extensive search. That would be very time-consuming or consume a lot of resources. So we're going to see that we can find some analytical solutions also. Now, we can take this and express it. We can do some mathematical manipulation and represent our estimator in terms of RVV and RPV. RVV is a cross-covariance matrix of the dipole elements, and RPV is a vector of the cross-correlation between the monopole and dipole elements. So RVV is 3 by 3. RPV is 3 by 1. This is an estimate of the cross-correlation. It's a sample cross-correlation. And we can, in our term here, we have an optimization problem. Here we have two terms here, a linear term, because Q appears only once. The second term is Q transpose RVVQ, and that's a quadratic term. And we have a unity constraint, and we're going to try to solve that. And first, we're going to expect two extreme cases. And we're going to inspect two cases, and we're going to see that these cases can be solved analytically. And the solutions which we find actually match estimators which were previously proposed. So our estimator is a special case of two previously proposed estimators. In the first case, we choose alpha to be close to 1. It's not quite a monopole, it's close to a monopole. A monopole has no directivity. If we have alpha being 1 minus epsilon, where epsilon approaches 0, there is some directivity. We have the problem can be turned into u hat equals argmax of q transpose RPV with the unity constraint. So we have a linear constraint, linear term, quadratic constraint. The solution can be shown to be the vector RPV normalized. And to our surprise, when we did the research, we found out that this method or this estimator was proposed earlier by Davies and by Narayan Pali in 87, 1994, but they used a different framework. So our framework actually matches them for one particular case. Another case is where alpha equals 0. For alpha equals 0, we have a dipole directivity. We have one quadratic term. We have the unity constraint. We can solve this analytically, and the solution is going to be u hat is the eigenvector, which corresponds to the largest eigenvalue of RVV. That's also an analytical solution. And this solution was also proposed earlier. So we show that our estimator is generalizes to previously proposed estimators. But now we have a more interesting case. What happens if we don't have a monopole or a dipole? We have something in between. So now we're not going to have alpha equal 0 or close to 1. We're going to have alpha be somewhere in between. The problem we have now is Q transpose RPV plus 1 minus alpha over 2, Q transpose RVVQ. There's both a linear and a quadratic term, a quadratic constraint. And to the best of our knowledge, there's no analytical solution to this. So we tried a numerical method. And we used the method of gradient descent. The gradient is computed below. There's one problem with gradient descent, that if we go in the direction of steepest ascent, as we take our steps, we're going to tend to leave the unit sphere, we're going to breach the constraint, and we have to solve the problem with the constraint. So this is our proposed algorithm. We start with initial guess. We step in the direction of the steepest ascent, and afterwards we normalize the vector q. And we repeat this process over and over again until we have convergence. It's not very time-consuming, and that's our method. And we can use it to solve it for any alpha. So now we see that there are two methods. We have a more general method. We'd like to be able to compare the results and see how they perform. So we need some type of term to evaluate how well our estimator performs. So we define the term, or the term has been defined earlier, angular error. Angular error means the following. We have u points in one, this is the true u, and we have another vector u hat. We take the angle between those two vectors, and that's the angular error. And that provides all the information we need to know how accurate one particular estimate is. The thing is, we're not dealing with one particular estimate. We're dealing with random processes. So we have to, the actual angular error for one particular scenario doesn't mean that much. So we're going to use, based on the angular error, the mean square angular error is defined. It was used, I think it was first proposed, to the best of my knowledge, by Norai in 1994. And the mean square angular error is the angular error squared times n as n approaches infinity. Okay, so now we have a way to measure, to evaluate the different estimators. We performed Monte Carlo simulations. So in a single trial, first we pick a unit vector u as the true DOA. Then we generate from a Gaussian distribution the signal component, the noise components for the four channels. Based on the different signals which we generate, we can calculate u hat. And we don't calculate one u hat. We calculate u hat for alpha ranging from 0 up until 1. And based on the single trial, we have a list of angular errors. And we repeat this trial over and over again. We did 100,000 independent trials. And then we can tabulate the list of angular errors. And based on the average, we can calculate the sample mean square angular error. And we can use that to compare the different estimators. So for a particular example, here are the results which we obtained. The results depend on the parameters, meaning it depends on the signal-to-noise ratio. It depends. And there are two types of noises. There's monopole noise and dipole noise. This is one particular simulation. The x-axis over here, that delineates the alpha parameter. The y-axis is the mean square angular error. And we can see that for alpha equals 0, that's the dipole estimator, the mean square angular error is a bit higher than 10. For the near monopole estimator, it's closer to 12. And what happens in between is more interesting. What happens in between is we have a shape which looks like a parabola, and it dips, it comes lower down. And at a particular value, at 0.45, it hits the minimum. Not only does it hit the minimum, but if we look at the red line over here, that's the Kramer-Rao lower bound. And we actually approached the Kramer-Rao lower bound, so that's the best possible estimate which could be, for an unbiased estimator, which can be obtained. So now I said that this is one particular example. If we did numerous simulations, and what happens is that for different parameters, These two edges of the graph take different heights, but we're always going to have some parabola. The parabola is always going to have some intermediate value alpha, and that value is, in all our simulations, hits the Kramer-Rey lower bound, which shows that we've obtained a measure of optimality. So to conclude, we're going to just say we used a vector sensor, which is inherently super directive. We derived a method for DOA estimation, and we showed that our DOA estimator actually generalizes two previous methods. And we showed that if we have a correct choice or selection of the parameter alpha, then we outperform the previous methods, and we can obtain the Kramer-Rey lower bound. I'd like to thank the audience. I'd like to thank my advisors, Sharon Ganot and Emmanuel Havitz. Thank you.
Thank you. And any questions?
Why do try to reduce the number of microphones acoustic vector and constraining? This is only for very low cost devices. The richness of array processing is in extending the number and the degree of freedoms.
So actually, you do have a good point. And in our future research, we'd like to research what happens when we take a number of vector sensors. But we'd also like to note that there are certain situations where we have space constraints, where we can't actually have an array of microphones with lambda or half lambda spacing. And in that case, super directive beamforming could be a good choice. But if space is not a constraint, then we can actually use other microphones to enrich the results. Okay. Right, so I think this might clarify. There are two different types of vector sensors. The first sensor here is a sound field microphone, and it uses four different gradient microphones in order to produce the different outputs. And that could actually be viewed as a classical array. There is a certain amount of spacing between them. I don't think it's desired, but even so, it's compact. The second sensor, which we have here, is a microphone. A microphone is a relatively new device, and this is a much enlarged picture. It's actually about looks closer to the size of a matchstick. This over here is the monopole sensor. The blue, red, and green are the dipole sensors. So we can obtain a very small spacing. That's the main difference. But it could also be viewed as a very specialized part or branch of array processing. It's a four sensor array. Four sensors. Okay. Right.
So can I confirm this uncorrelation is in temporal domain or spatial domain? And how you justify this uncorrelation?
Okay, so we could do this. The way which we did our study was we used a broadband signal. We could also do an equivalent analysis for a narrowband signal. And you asked how we justify. So narrowband would be the spectral domain. How do we justify this? So if we're dealing with sensor noise, then it makes sense that the four different sensors are not correlated with each other. But I said something which is a little bit more, it's not quite intuitive, but if you check the results, their papers would show this. If we take a diffuse noise field, meaning we have noise coming from a sphere in all directions, and it's isotropic, then the four components are also going to be uncorrelated. They're going to have a diagonal matrix of one, third, a third, a third. Now, that doesn't sound so intuitive because they're all measuring the same signal, It could be justified from the, or it could be justified mathematically based on the orthogonality of the different spherical harmonics. And if you want, I could afterwards refer you to the papers.
Any more questions?
Actually, that's a good question. It depends. It depends very much on these two parameters. The parameter here, this is the monopole noise, and this is the dipole noise. If they're going to have equal noise, then the answer is going to be what you said is going to be a half. In this particular simulation, we had the monopole noise was slightly higher, and then the value, the optimal value wasn't half; it was 0.45. If we were to have a case where the where let's say the monopole or the dipoles would be have much higher noise than the other, then we'd have a parabola which would be centered maybe either over here or over here. So it depends on the scenario. We plan on doing or publishing more research about that question also. We didn't view it. I'm researching a vector sensor. But if you were to use maybe a eigenmic, so I could feasibly see that type of approach. I'm thinking out loud because I didn't do the research. But instead of having alpha, we'd have since we have several harmonics, we'd have a much richer problem. I don't know if we'd be able to solve it analytically. I don't know if it would be tractable or not, but it is an interesting direction.
Any more questions?
When alpha hits 1, not that you did that, you have it slightly less than 1, but if it were actually 1, then there would be no directionality at all, and therefore no means of determining where, what direction.
Right.
Is there an intuitive explanation as to why you get this parabolic response rather than something asymptotic?
Okay, so that's a good question. And you could also say that how come when we have a near monopole, we have alpha being 1 minus epsilon, why is there any directivity? The directivity is really negligible. So the answer which I can give is that we did an analytical evaluation, and this near monopole can actually be decomposed into spherical harmonics. The DC, or the zero order, is the dominant one, but that one doesn't have any effect on maximization. If you have a very large constant, and after the constant you also have something which changes, then the constant doesn't have any effect. So even though the monopole appears, or the near monopole appears to have no directivity, when we look at the mathematics, we can nullify the non-directional part, and we're going to have a beam pattern which does have a considerable amount of directionality. But it's true that when you look at the picture, it seems odd. But the mathematical analysis shows that we do have directivity.
Okay. Thank you very much again.
Thank you.